My shameless product plug for this episode is RTS Online Coaching. Not a day goes by where I don't get an email, direct message on social media, or a random comment on my website from someone who wants to get into great shape but doesn't know where to start. Now look, I get it, and I've been there too. But if there's one distinct pattern in my life with regards to training, it's this. When I have a coach, I always get better results than just trying to figure it out on my own. If you're struggling to get into great shape, or have issues you need to work around, or maybe just need some accountability from someone you trust, then maybe it's time to consider online coaching with yours truly. I've been working with clients online for the past 11 years, and while I don't promote it often, this is yet another aspect of my coaching business that I truly enjoy. If you're interested in starting up or simply learning more about the process, I've got two options for you. Number one, if you're ready to get started ASAP, just go to robertsontrainingsystems.com/coaching and sign up for one of my training packages. Or if you'd like to learn more about the process, you'll go to that same page and simply fill out the application form. If I still have spaces left, I'll reach out to you to schedule a consulting call and see if we're a good fit for each other. Regardless of what you're looking for or the package you're interested in, you'll want to go to robertsontrainingsystems.com/coaching for more information. And this last part is really important. I'm only going to be accepting new clients through the end of July. So if you're interested, please either sign up or fill out that form ASAP. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to working with you. Hello, and welcome to the Physical Preparation Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Robertson, and I'll be joined on the line later today by Darren Burgess. Now, unfortunately, this week, not a ton of updates because I'm actually recording this a week ahead of time. If you are listening to this as it's released, I am on my last day of vacation, hopefully enjoying the beautiful weather and low humidity in Michigan. I'm projecting there. Hopefully that's the case. But yeah, just trying to wrap up this vacation, hopefully enjoying myself and, you know, doing my best to keep the content coming for you, even though I'm out of town and not really working too hard this week. So before we jump into this show with Darren, I want to highlight something that he and I touch on in this show. It's something that I feel very strongly about, something that I use quite often myself, and I think it's something that if you don't use it, you should consider adding to the arsenal or to the repertoire, so to speak. And that is the concept or the idea of forced recovery. Now, I don't know about you guys. I don't want to say high strung, but I am definitely what I would describe as a high achiever. I don't know if I've achieved a lot, but I attempt to achieve a lot. I've got that mindset, right? I'm very on the go, sometimes struggle to shut my brain off. So for me, a lot of times just sitting around and doing nothing doesn't really work, right? That idea sometimes of being still doesn't work because inevitably that leads to me wanting to check my phone or wanting to get up and do something and be active, even if it's, you know, something ridiculous like cleaning the garage or doing, you know, the dishes, anything, cleaning the house, things like that kind of set my mind at ease. So there are times when recovery for me is an issue. So the concept that Darren and I talk about and something that, again, I espouse very highly is the idea of forced recovery. And so essentially it's finding ways to make you shut your system down. So if you look at little kids, right? Like they struggle when they get ramped up, like my son or my daughter, if they get really amped up and they can't control their emotions, maybe they yell or maybe they cry. And that works as the resolution that gives them that parasympathetic kind of rev up, if you will, to balance their system back out. But I think sometimes as adults, you know, I don't know about you, I don't cry every day. I'm not like depressed or something like that. I don't go out and just rage. So I have to find other ways to process and balance that autonomic nervous system. And I think this is something that whether people want to talk about it or not, I think it's something that a vast majority of our population deals with. They're constantly in this heightened sympathetic state or this sympathetic dominance. I don't know the scientifically specific term that I should use here, but they're basically more jacked and wired than they need to be, and they struggle to resolve it. So forced recovery are methods that you can use to work and shut your system down. So, you know, one that's worked fantastically well for me, and I've talked about it numerous times on the show, is meditation, right? And there are times, even still, I struggle to shut my brain off and shut my system off. But for me, Mr. Andy in Headspace seems to do the trick. And I'll tell you, there are times that I just want to check the box and I may only do it for a minute or 3 minutes. But if I do that for a couple of days in a row, I notice a difference. So for me, there's got to be a certain amount of time. For me, it's a minimum of 5, but preferably 10 minutes. And if I can go 10 to 15 minutes when I meditate, it's enough recovery and it's enough kind of down regulating of my sympathetic overdrive to get my system back into a better balance. So meditation is one, but that's not even my favorite. The other two may cost you a little bit of cash, but I think they are incredibly valuable. And those are massage and flotation tanks. These are two things that, you know, I don't know, guys, for me personally, make such a huge impact because there's not the threat of me getting a call or getting a text or dealing with a screaming child, right? The room is dark. It's an appropriate temperature. It's an environment that's conducive to shutting everything off. And you know what? It's totally normal. If you get a massage or you lay in a float tank, maybe those first 10 to 15 minutes, you just can't shut down, right? Like a lot of times what happens to me, I get like this brain dump of ideas and all this stuff kind of surfaces and bubbles up. And it may not even necessarily be bad. It's just thoughts and ideas like, oh crap, I forgot, you know, to whatever, buy this at the store, or, oh, I forgot to call this person back. But what I find is, again, if you've got enough time in there, 45 minutes to an hour, a lot of times your system shuts down. And when you are done with that session, you immediately feel like you can take on the world. So these are things that if you're like me, if you tend to push yourself really hard, if you're a go-getter, achiever type, if you're kind of sympathetically driven, look into some of these different methods for forced recovery. And again, the three that I mentioned today, meditation, massage, float tanks. I think either one or a combination of all three can make a really big impact in your health, in your life, in your performance. And again, sometimes it's a blend of all of these, right? Like for me, meditation now is kind of a daily thing. The other stuff is more intermittent, but it's also more impactful and more powerful because it's a longer duration. But if you guys can start doing this stuff on the regular, I think it's going to make a profound impact on how you feel and how you perform. So that's my two cents for today. Now enough for me. Let's get into the show with Darren. Darren Burgess is the head of high performance for Arsenal Football Club. Prior to this, he's held roles for Liverpool, Port Adelaide of the AFL, and the Australian national soccer team. This is Darren's second time on the show, and one thing I love about chatting with him is how it feels like we've known each other forever. He's an incredibly easy guy to get along with, and I think he's got a ton of awesome insights about working with athletes. In this show, Darren and I talk about how to move seamlessly between different sports, how he balances the demands of athletes who play for both their club and country, and what he means when he talks about giving his players a systematic exposure to speed training. There's a ton of gems in this talk, and I know you're going to love it. Let's do this. Darren, man, thank you so much for coming back on the show here today. Really excited to catch up with you. For those that may have missed our first show together, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Mike. It's fantastic to be back. It's really a privilege that you consider asking me back. Love the podcast, and it keeps me very much entertained while I'm running through the cold streets of London. But I've been involved in a couple of different sports, mainly soccer for the American listeners, or football and Aussie rules. High performance manager at Port Adelaide AFL club. the Australian soccer team in the 2010 World Cup, and then back to Port Adelaide for another 4-year stint, and in between that had 3 years, around about 3 years at Liverpool, and I've just finished 1 year and one day of high performance director at Arsenal Football Club, so back in England.
You know, I was going to ask you, you know, what's new and what's going on, but I mean, as we were talking about before we got on the show, I mean, you're on a totally different continent than the last time we chatted, so obviously quite a bit is new for you, right?
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. I think I probably mentioned to you that I was really happy at Port Adelaide, and AFL's a great code for guys like you and I to work in. It's really respectful of everything that we do, and I thought I'd be there forever. And then an opportunity came completely out of the blue to come back and do a slightly different role to the one I did in the UK last time. So it was sort of too good an opportunity to pass up. So it's good to be back. Good to be back, I guess. Trying to have fun.
I love it, man. And just so the listeners know, you are literally in the midst of preseason, so we should be very thankful that we got a couple minutes of your time right now.
It's interesting right now because we've had a manager for 23 years at Arsenal, which is just unheard of in most professional sports, let alone the Premier League, where the average manager tenancy is about 2.5 years. Yep. And so this club's just undergone a massive change in the medical performance coaching department in the last sort of 5 weeks. We've got a new Spanish coach and he's brought his coaching staff with him, so we're 4 days into preseason, and it's been a fascinating couple of weeks to be part of it, I guess.
Absolutely. So I want to start with the fact that I'm just really intrigued by the fact that you seem to, at least outwardly, to be able to just move in between two sports so seamlessly. It's something that I personally try to do between soccer and basketball, and I'd love to focus on some of the differences between soccer and the AFL with you. So just for beginners, could you talk about some of the physical differences between AFL and soccer athletes?
Physically, they're actually quite similar. The main differences, Mike, are in the outputs, I guess, that they have to put out in games. And most people think that AFL goes for 2 hours and the guys can run 15, 16 kilometers. But when you break it down in a per minute basis, they're actually quite similar. The biggest difference is the soccer players have far more accelerations and decelerations and therefore agility. And that's just the demands of the sports. Whereas the AFL guys, they're involved a lot more physical contact. So it's a 360-degree game. You can get tackled from any angle at any time, really. So the strength to hold off an opponent, although important in soccer, is far more important in AFL. So the main physical differences are that the 16, 18 week preseason that AFL puts their players through versus we got basically a 5 week preseason with sort of 8 official games in that time. So you can imagine, we're straight into games straight away. So there's some big differences, but also a lot of similarities.
You know, after our last show, I went and watched basically a game of AFL. And I feel like I'd maybe watched a game or two loosely when I was over there years ago. But, you know, after having talked to you, I watched a game and I was just shocked at how much those guys run. I mean, it is crazy to watch guys in the AFL.
Yeah, it's a big field. It's normally about 170 meters long by about 130 meters wide. And the way that the game's played at the moment, the running demands are really high, just because there's a lot of rotations, a bit like ice hockey, and imagine trying to do that across a 180 meter field. So the running component really is a dominant feature. And generally speaking, if you can't run, you can't play. Although it's a highly skilled sport, even the highly skilled guys have to run.
Yeah, that's crazy. So let's take the next logical step there. How does that impact your planning and programming for your soccer players now versus what you were doing with your AFL guys?
Yeah, that's probably been the the trick or what I've had to re-educate myself on a little bit, Mike, coming back over here, is I'd had four pre-seasons of AFL, which is, as I said before, 16, 18 weeks of just a lot of running and really building up a massive resilience in these guys so that when the demanding season comes, they can tolerate that. You just don't get that opportunity in soccer. The season goes for for our guys about 44, 45 weeks. We have guys who are playing in the World Cup at the moment and are playing their 66th game. So it's really grueling to put your body through all those Excels and D-cells that I spoke about earlier, but you don't have much time to prepare, so it really is it's not a gradual build-up and then a taper off before the season. You sort of ramp it up pretty quickly and then try and get a taper before the season, but you've got to hold it for as long as possible because it's a long season and you can't afford, a physical decline, particularly in England where there's no winter break, whereas in every other European league, you get, between 2 and 3 weeks off, some 4 weeks off over Christmas, where we just keep playing. So the periodization is more of an agile one rather than any kind of linear periodization.
Yeah. It's just mind blowing to me because, I was actually talking with Matej Hasovar, who is from Slovenia, yep, a couple weeks ago. And I mean, he was saying that they might have a 2 week off season. It's not uncommon for them to have 2 weeks. I lament there are times with some of my soccer guys that may only have 6 or 8 weeks. And here he is talking about a 2 week off season. So I promised him, yeah, I would never complain about the brevity of the American soccer off season after having talked to you guys.
Yeah, it's some of our guys, so we had guys knocked out in the World Cup this past week, and they are due back in sort of 3 weeks time. And most of them, and some of the players are like, right, where's my program for that 3 weeks? I'm like, hey, just relax. No. We've got a new coach. We've got a new regime. We play Manchester City round one. I need a program. I'm like, okay, no problem. I love it. So, yeah, these guys don't get much of an off-season at all.
Well, I'm going to actually jump ahead a little bit here because I wanted to talk about this. Like, with the World Cup going on right now, this seems really pertinent. What concessions do you have to make for that athlete who has the dual role or the dual commitment of playing for both their club and their country?
The big thing, Mike, is in season when these guys go off and play for their country, it's obviously a tremendous honour for them to represent their country. So you have to respect that. So in season, there's about seven or maybe six international windows, and the guys that don't play for their country, and well, we're lucky or unlucky at Arsenal that most of our guys do play for their country, they just don't get any time off in that time because they go and then they're under all kinds of pressure, both commercially, mentally, and physically, to go and play for their country. Add to that the fact that we have a bunch of South Americans that go and fly from London to, Argentina and Colombia and Uruguay to play in some, in front of 100,000 people in their hometowns. So, the concessions that you make are a lot of recovery time, really respect the mental drain that goes on top of the traveling strain that these guys are under to try and accommodate for that. And really, it's probably a mistake I made early in my career, really respect the player and not just necessarily the numbers. Yeah. So really deal with each player as an individual and find out who can tolerate those loads a little better than others.
One of the things that I like to think about a lot is the term that I describe as forced recovery, right? And trying to find ways to just make people basically shut down, and sometimes that's like massage or sometimes that's a float tank, things of that nature. Do you find you have to do the same sorts of things with your athletes, especially these guys that are, accumulating 50, 60 matches over the course of a year?
Exactly. And the two modalities that you just mentioned there are great because most of the time we enforce our guys, you can't have your phone in the massage room. So it actually forces them because if you check any of your guys and the Arsenal players Instagram accounts. They got, you know, we've got guys who've got over 10, 11 million followers. So,
oh my gosh,
they'd just be on Instagram and they just have to send out an innocent message, and then, you know, probably 100,000 people are going to send back probably abusive messages if they've had a bad game. Or so even that creates a stress that has an impact on them physically and certainly mentally. So a float tank is ideal. Yoga, massage, meditation, anything where the technology is off, their body is recuperating, and you're forcing them into a little bit of silence, really, so that they can process what they're actually doing and just take their mind off anything to do with football. We're all over, and we're trying to educate our guys, because they come from different cultures, about the benefits of that. So I like that concept of forced recovery for sure.
So talk to me about the communication. And again, sticking with this theme of club and country, how much communication do you have? Because like you said, you could have guys that are local, you know, to England, and you could have guys from all over South America that, you know, you have to keep tabs on. So how does that work as far as the communication process goes? Do you have some sort of ongoing dialogue with all of the medical staffs from these different teams, or how does that work?
Yeah, we do. And if I don't, certainly we've got Shad Forsyth on our staff here, who's got a great relationship with a bunch of different countries and speaks a bunch of different languages. So he's developed that. So he can speak to the conditioning guys, and our doctor, Gary O'Driscoll, can speak to all the medical guys about any issues, particularly with the World Cup. You know, most organisations were really, really on the front foot and were in touch with us close to Christmas time for a six-month lead-in. Any problems with any of our players, any tips on how to treat them well, and can you give us their training loads? And, you know, some countries are more detailed than others. Doesn't necessarily make them better, but the communication lines are good. And the players ultimately, if they know that you're in it for the right reasons, they'll respond as well. So we have WhatsApp groups and things like that where players can share some issues and things like that. So it's pretty good.
That's awesome. So let's come back to this idea of preparation, especially leading into the season, because as you alluded to, you know, in the EPL, you've got 5, maybe 6 weeks if you're lucky, and that's not counting these guys that are playing in the World Cup, versus the AFL, where you may have 16 to 18 weeks. So how does that impact your planning of the off-season period for your soccer guys? What are you trying to accomplish? What are maybe your big rocks in that preseason period? And ultimately, what do you want to get out of it to make sure that they're ready to go and play 45, 50, 60 matches in a year?
A great question, and probably one that most Premier League clubs are thinking about at the moment, or have been thinking about. So, purely from a soccer point of view, we also have a trip to Singapore, which is about 34, 35 degrees and about 90% humidity this time of year to consider, which is the commercial requirements of being in, you know, one of the bigger clubs around. So you can't complain, because that's the reality of it. So the big rocks for us are getting some gradual but high-intensity speed exposure, and I guess by nature it's speed, so it has to be high intensity, but to expose them to that gradually early, and then often once you have exposed them to top speeds. And it's important to do that in the first couple of weeks, really, which is not necessarily what you might do if you had longer time. But certainly in the first couple of weeks, because they're going to be playing games after 2 weeks, and you know, the ball doesn't respect what your periodization plan is. So you need to do that. Certainly some eccentric, posterior and anterior chain exercises, knee and hip dominant. We need to get that into our players to try and develop some resilience, because as good as your off-season program is, most athletes tend to do about 60-70% of it. So we try and test them early to see what they have done, and then progress them on that. And then right now for us, it's the change of direction load in soccer is intense, particularly with a new coach. So that's the other load that we're trying to bring in and I guess protect against, because I'm not going to tell a brand new coach who might only have a year or two to impress well, you can't do that drill because it's too intense. Like that's crazy. So we respect the fact that they're going to go out and drill pretty hard and intensely, and then we try and protect the players for that.
You know, I just love the fact, because we talk a ton about hamstring health, right? And I feel like so many times people are very good about, hey, we're going to do some of the eccentric work, we're going to get the Nordics in and that sort of thing. But I think a lot of times people miss the boat on, hey, sometimes going out and sprinting and being smart about like slowly building up that sprint tolerance, if you will, is one of the best protective measures we have for preventing these hamstring injuries. And especially in your world, right? Like, you've got to protect these because you can't afford for a guy to be out 6-8 weeks.
No, look, when your average salary can be in the range, you know, the average team salary might be around 100,000 a week. You know, it's a lot of money to be sitting on the sidelines if people are doing hamstrings. So look, I'm not saying we're perfect, but what we try and do is put in a process. And sprinting, you know, it's interesting, the debate about Nordics, and obviously I'm a fan, and you need to include them along with anterior chain and hip and knee dominant exercise. All of them form part of our injury prevention strategies, but sprinting forms the major part of it, and systematic exposure to speed. If we happen to play in a really slow game where the ball's out of play a lot and players don't get their top speed, well, they're going to hit it either straight after the game or during the week, because you just can't afford for guys not to have repeat or regular exposures. Otherwise, you're just putting those players, particularly their hamstrings, at risk.
I love that phrase, a systematic exposure to speed, right? Because the other side is too, like people say, oh, well, we need to go out and sprint. And then all of a sudden, they just crush these guys and get overloaded. And then they pull a hamstring when they're trying to prevent the hamstring pull in the first place, or something else, right? So I love that description of it, a systematic exposure to speed. That's really good.
And it has to be individual too, Mike, which I know is common sense to you. It's the speed exposure that our right wing back, Hector Bellerin from Spain, needs is very, very different to the speed exposure that our centre back from last year, Per Mertesacker, needs. You know, so we individualise it and we tailor it to each player's A, game requirements, and B, tolerance. Because ultimately, all we're trying to do above all else is win matches of soccer. That's it. And the best chance of doing that is to give our manager, we don't have the money that some other clubs do, so we want to give our manager his fittest and best team each week, and that'll give us the best chance of winning. So that's all we're trying to do.
I love it. Okay, so along the same lines, as you've alluded to as well, the length of the EPL season is pretty ridiculous. I mean, you guys are going 45, 46 weeks out of the year. So what have you found, both, you know, during your last year here with Arsenal and your previous stint with Liverpool, what have you found are some best practices for managing your athletes over that course or period of time?
I think the first thing, and this is a little bit different and probably different to what I would do 10, 15 years ago when I was more of a scientist rather than more a generalist, is try and have fun as much as you can and try and make the training environment as relaxing as it can be. Now, we lost a bunch of games last year and it cost the manager his job. So at times the sessions were intense, the scrutiny was unbelievable. But if we can make our warm-ups, our gym sessions, our recovery sessions, a little bit of enjoyment, a little bit of relaxation, then that's one step that we can do. In terms of managing their loads, it's a really individual thing that we take a lot of care in doing, and that involves physical, mental load with a full-time psychologist who helps us out a lot in that area. So it really is trying to look at each player and say, right, where is he at in the spectrum? Of course we do, you know, GPS and heart rate and wellness and heart rate variability and things like that, and we put them all into a big pot and have a look. We have daily meetings about player status, weekly meetings about overall player progress. And so what we try and do is have a look at each individual player. We've got 27 in the squad, so it's not a huge squad compared to AFL. and we can go through each player and say, what does he need this week in order to get through? What's he got coming up and what does he need this week? So we try and put the science, the art, the skill set of all the people in the performance team, of which there's 15, 16, together and say, right, what's the best thing for each player? So is it perfect? Absolutely not. And I'm sure if people came in, they go, oh, you don't do this and you don't do that. But what we try and do is tick off the areas that we think are the big rocks and put the player first.
You know, one thing I was always shocked by, and again, your experience greatly trumps mine in the team world, but one thing that I'm always shocked by is how much simple things like changing the warm-up or just certain elements of the program, like swapping out an exercise, or on Friday, like one of the things we always joke around is we do Arm Farm Friday. You know, so Friday, we're going to do some arm work before the weekend. Like little things like that can make such a profound impact on how your athletes not only respond to the training session, but to you as their coach.
Oh, look, exactly right. And little wins like that, you're 100% right, Mike. We did things halfway through last year, which we had the guy who normally does a warm-up couldn't make a game, so a different guy came in and did the warm-up. We kept him for five or six games and then rotated a little bit just to mix it up. We went to a stadium that played a lot of really loud music, and a few of the guys were talking about it afterwards, how good was that in the warm-up? So we added that to our pre-game warm-up, you know. Watch the Seattle Seahawks train, if anybody's ever done that, a couple of years ago with a bunch of players, and they loved that they had a DJ helping them warm up. So we couldn't afford a DJ at Port Adelaide, so we just got a big loud set of speakers and put that in the warm-up, and the players just loved it. So anything that you can add a little bit of extra stimulus, a bit of enjoyment, make it player-centered, I think can help. So you're 100% right, Mike.
I love it. Well, last but not least, I think one of the things that most people really can't account for until they get in there is the massive cultural differences when you go in between sports. And for example, in my world, soccer and basketball, there's just massive cultural differences between the type of athlete you're working with. Obviously, you know, like the shape and the size, those are big differences. But, you know, just the cultural differences, the way these people grew up, the backgrounds that they have, you know, there's the lingo that you use. There's so much difference there. So do you find the same things when you're moving in between the AFL and the soccer world?
Yeah, it's a great point. And to be honest with you, Mike, when I went from AFL into the Australian soccer team, I had a bit of a soft landing. But if I'd have gone AFL straight into the Premier League, I don't reckon I would have lasted, because I would have come with my AFL sort of beliefs and we must do it this way and we must do it that way, and I would have been kicked out. So you absolutely have to do that, and you can always tell people who only last a year or so when they do change sports. It's probably not their skill set, not their talent, not their education. It's probably, you know, not respecting the culture of the change. So I was lucky that I spent a bit of time at Liverpool to come into this particular environment and respect the culture. And it's not being lazy to observe, but you need to observe what's going on. I'd be foolish to come into a club like Arsenal and say, you know what, I've got all the answers. You guys have been doing it wrong. I've got all the answers. That's just insane. So respect the culture. Have a look at what may need some adjustment based on what you've been brought in to do. But absolutely, the in-sport culture and soccer to NBA is an amazing shift for you. So my hat goes off to you for that. AFL to soccer is not as big as what you've done from what I know. So it's an important thing. Don't come in with your own beliefs and say, I must do it this way because that's what I've been educated. No. Guys have been doing it for years in different sports, so respect that and have a look at it and see where you can maybe make some minor adjustments.
Yeah, I just think that's such great advice, too, to kind of, I don't want to say bite your tongue, but kind of just take a step back, really observe, kind of get your bearings before you start throwing, you know, your two cents in on everything. Yes. Because like you said, so much of it is just building trust. forging these relationships with these athletes. And again, like, you're uncomfortable, right, as a coach,
yes,
just because it's a different environment. And I'm a big believer that if you're uncomfortable or unsure of yourself, like, people sense that, you know? Yes. So rather than coming out and being unsure of yourself or maybe unconfident and then trying to say, these are all the things you're doing wrong, like you said, take the time, step back, get a feel for their culture, you know, what's going on there. What are some easy wins that you can cultivate very early on to build trust and forge relationships? And then everything you do from there is going to be so much easier.
Oh, absolutely. I genuinely believe that it took me 8 months to build any kind of trust with the Liverpool players when I first went there. And I reckon they were thinking for the first 8 months, who is this Aussie, you know, standing in the background and you know, occasionally telling us what to do. It literally took 8 months of, you know, being the first to be there, the last to leave, snowing, raining, whatever, being there, just there to help, there to lend a hand. And, you know, I'm assuming that they believe me by after the 8 months. But yeah, it takes time. Great advice, Mike, for sure.
It just reminds me too, like, one of the soccer guys I worked with, I had a really good rapport, you know, I think of it in years, right, with the Indy 11. So we're in year five, but like year three, I had a really good rapport with, you know, like half the team was back. So I knew like half of them, the other half were new, and I slowly felt like I was winning them over, but there was like one or two, like all year. And I, you know, just keep checking the box, you know, treat them the same, try and reach out to them. And it wasn't until, like you said, like month nine, one of the guys was like, man, hadn't gotten through with the guy all year, but he's like, man, my back's really hurting me. Do you have something that can help me out? You know? So then, like you said, hey man, you keep chipping away. And eventually if you keep showing up, hopefully they'll know that you're there to help them out.
And probably the other thing with the advent of social media and everybody's connected and everybody's, you know, has access to different people's programs and things like that. I think sometimes we're quick to judge and say, no, that's not right. Why would he be doing that? Well, you don't know the specific culture of that particular exercise. You know, that's probably why they're doing it for that particular environment. So, you know, as an industry, we shouldn't be quick to judge other people's programs, exercises, progressions, whatever else we might have access to, because we haven't lived in their shoes and had to work through whatever scenario they've had to work through.
I love that. And it's something Joe Ken and I actually just talked about. Too often, like you said, we're quick to judge and we see a certain exercise or a program and we're wondering, well, why would they do that? But like you just said, we don't understand the constraints that they may have.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Everybody's got different constraints on how they can operate, the exercises, the culture. So until you really understand that, you don't understand why that program looks the way that it does.
No, exactly right. And if you don't understand, just ask.
Yes.
You just say, because we're only too happy to help. Like, you know, most people in this industry are good people and they're only too happy to exchange information. So I'm really happy if, you know, anybody wants to ask a question or anything like that. I love the debate and I certainly take that up with people. If I see them do something that I don't understand, I'll just ask.
I love it. So I want to ask you one question that really just kind of popped up because we've already done the big question, but I think, you know, here in the States, everybody realizes like the EPL is about as good as it gets when it comes to the soccer world. And I know there's a lot of coaches that I've talked to, young coaches that are coming up, you know, now they don't want to just work in, you know, a college sector. They may not even want to work in the MLS. Their goal is to work in the EPL. So as somebody that's been there, what advice would you give to a young coach that wants to get a job and they want to thrive working in the EPL?
The advice that I give most people when they want to work in the industry, period, let alone the EPL, is if they're not working with a team, go and find a team. And that's amateur, volunteer. You know, if we had an extra hour and a half of this podcast, Mike, I'd take you through the teams that I volunteered for while I was delivering pizzas and things like that. So you just have to – the industry is too small, and there's a lot of people who want to work in it. So go and find a team so you can make mistakes with that team, get comfortable with the team, get comfortable speaking in front of a team, designing programs, dealing with all the things that, you know, that you have to deal with within that team environment. Once you've done that and you've got some experience up, it's there's a little bit of networking that you have to do in terms of knocking on doors and emailing and sending LinkedIn CVs and things like that. And then it's don't be afraid to either come over and contact people in the industry and say, can I just come and observe, or just can I come and have a coffee or something like that. The best thing you can do is go and find a soccer team somewhere and work your way up. I literally started with under 13s, under 14s, and did everything, strapping ankles, filling drink bottles, all that sort of stuff, and then worked your way up from there. So you just have to start at that level and just continue and keep plugging away. Often one of the frustrating things about the EPL is often you get, once you're aligned to a coach, you sort of follow that person around. So I haven't sort of done that yet because I've had a bunch of coaches in my time over here. That can be a frustrating thing, so I get that. But that doesn't mean that, you know, there's 20 clubs in the EPL. There's 90-odd professional clubs in England, so you might have to start a little bit lower and work your way into it. But get a team, do as much team-based coaching as you can.
I love it because, again, if you're listening to this and you want to work at the highest level, I love that. I respect that. But like Darren just said, you're probably not going to start off at Arsenal, Liverpool, Man U, yeah. Man City. You start with the fifth division club, you know, where you're doing all the jobs and you work your way up. I love it.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's move on. Let's jump into our lightning round here because I've got some interesting stuff and I want to get your feedback here. So number one, how has the transition been moving from Australia back to England?
It's probably been a bit easier this time because I knew what to expect. And also London is a very different place to live than Liverpool. When you move to London, you've got access to a lot of other different countries. So, you know, I've been able to go to a bunch of different places in and around the UK, in and around Europe, a lot more readily than at Liverpool. So it's a slightly different role. I don't have to be at every single session and every single game like at Liverpool. So it's been good. I've enjoyed it. I miss Adelaide a lot and miss the AFL, but I've really enjoyed the transition, both personally and professionally.
That's awesome. All right, number two, what's one failure that you've dealt with in the past, and how has it made you a better coach or clinician?
I might have alluded to it earlier. Well, I'll give you two. In fact, I'll give you double your money. Like, one is obsessing too much on numbers, and worrying too much about, you know, probably 10 years ago, I worried too much about GPS, and GPS was horrible 10 years ago. You know, you may as well just guess. So, but I worried too much about that 10 years ago, not about the player. And it really early on in my career, and this is probably as good advice as I can give people, is I got too close to players. I thought it was really cool working with, you know, professional athletes and AFL players when I was 22, 23, and, you know, you'd go out for a drink with them and they treat you really well and they'd come down and watch you play, and so you think they're your buddies. But in my first role with the Sydney Swans, there came a full-time job and I applied for it, and I'd been part-time for 4 years, and the guy who was employing said, listen, you're too close to the players, and he was right. He was 100% right. So even though it's kind of cool to be buddies with some of these players, you have to respect the relationship. So that would be some advice that I'd give younger people, and certainly a mistake I made.
It's such good advice, and I think it's something that gets easier as we get older, because obviously the players are younger and we don't have the same interests as they do at 22, 23, but I could not agree more. I think I was in that same boat where you lose it's not necessarily your professional credibility, but you lose the ability to be critical, even if it's coming from the right place.
Yes, and the players have to respect you, and if they see you out drinking and, you know, whatever else, there's no respect to be had there. You might be having a good time, but there's no respect to be had when it really comes time to ask them to do some uncomfortable things.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, number three, when you're in this position, obviously everything in the EPL, it's what have you done for me lately, right? You have to perform every year. So what's one goal that you've set for yourself, or maybe one thing that you want to accomplish over the next year in your current position?
I want to learn Spanish.
Okay.
So that's a goal, both, you know, it's a personal goal, but it's professional as well, because I'm in a Spanish environment at the moment. So I'd really like to do that. I don't know if that counts.
That's fantastic.
I've started, and I'll hopefully see it through Spanish with an Australian accent. Should be interesting.
It's something that the first 2 years with the Indy 11, we had a lot of Spanish speaking guys, especially from Honduras. And I mean, these guys, they spoke no English.
Yes.
So if I didn't try and break that wall down a little bit, and I would go in and, you know, I mean, I was doing Duolingo, you know, on my phone at night trying to learn.
Yeah, I'm on it. But I'm on it now.
So I did that, and I tried to find, you know, like coaching cues, right? So I could at least give them the coaching cues that I use the most in the gym. I could give that to them in Spanish, and, you know, I wouldn't say it was perfect, but it was definitely better than the alternative. So,
and even if it means that they're laughing at you, that's fine. Yes. It's an icebreaker, and that's
absolutely
just fine.
Absolutely. I'm sure. The first person to make fun of myself. So.
Exactly right. For sure.
All right. Last but not least, number four, what's next for Darren Burgess?
Well, I reckon when you asked me this last time, I said happily ever after in Port Adelaide, and then that didn't quite happen. So, look, I don't know. I'm really happy here. I'm really excited about where this place is heading in terms of, you know, a change in everything that we do, really. So what's next is ride the bumps of this year, and then maybe I'll speak to you this time next year and see where we're at. I'm here for another 2 years, and I don't plan on going anywhere either before, during, or after that, to be honest, because it's such a great club to work for.
Well, I'm going to have to get serious and get over there, because I was used to we've got to meet in person, number one, because every time we chat, I feel like we've known each other for years.
Exactly, yeah.
But, man, I just love to see what you and Shad are up to.
Yeah, you'd love it. And the academy is fantastic. Des Ryan and the academy does a great job. So anytime, Mike, you just let me know and you'd be more than welcome.
Yes, I'll take you up on that. All right. Well, Darren, you've been awesome today, my friend. I know it's late over there. Where can my listeners find out more about you and what you have going on?
Probably the best bet is probably Twitter. I'm not as active as I probably once was, but sure. That's the best bet. And that's at Darren Burgess 25.
Perfect. I'll make sure I get that in the show notes. But again, Darren, thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
No worries, Mike. Anytime at all.
All right, guys, that does it for this week's show with Darren. Sincerely hope you enjoyed it. I don't know about you guys, but I just find Darren is one of the easiest guys to get on with. We always have a great discussion. It feels like we've known each other forever. And I think he's just got this really balanced and pragmatic approach to working with his athletes. And it's something I just find very, very refreshing. So again, hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, if you haven't already, make sure subscribe. If you already subscribed, take a minute, rate and review the show on iTunes. You know, we're slowly creeping up there. Last time I checked, we were at 55, 56 reviews. That really makes a big difference in how many people, you know, see the show and how many people can hopefully be positively impacted by the show. So I know it's going to take a minute or two of your time, but if you can do that for me, I would sincerely appreciate it. And with that being said, enough for me. Thanks again for your support. Love and appreciate you. And we'll be back soon with our next episode. Take care.